This is the Ballpark Digest broadcaster chat. We are back. I'm Jesse Goldberg-Strassler, and let me welcome back in my co-host, Mick Gillespie. Mick, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good to hear your voice, Jesse. How you been?
It is good to hear your voice, too. I have been, first, a day after tornadoes. I have been relocated because of flooding, and I've been through my very first earthquake. It was a pretty eventful first half of the Midwest League season. How about you?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to compare to that. I mean, a lot of rainouts, but no earthquakes, no tornadoes, just a lot of rain. Now, tell us about the tornado, though, and the earthquake. I got to hear the stories.
Okay, so we're going to Dayton, Ohio, and the night before we travel over, and we could have traveled the night before, but in general, we try to travel that morning. That night, terrible tornadoes ripped through the Dayton area, especially north of the ballpark. And we're driving in. The next day, we see all the devastation all around us, to our left and to our right. Everyone that I saw at Fifth Third Field, who works for the Dayton Dragons, I was asking everyone, hey, were you affected? And I did hear from people. One person said that their son had the only intact apartment from his apartment complex left standing. The ballpark that day, the entire downtown area was without power for a little bit, so they had to boil water. It was terrible. And then you can forget fast-forwarding, all the while throughout the first half of this year, the Quad Cities River Bandits, despite having the best team in the Midwest League's Western Division, has had to play the majority of its first half on the road because Davenport, Iowa, has been flooded. So when the Lansing Lugnuts took on the Quad Cities River Bandits, we were relocated to play at the University of Iowa's campus in Iowa City. They couldn't get the games in Davenport. If you've seen any of the photos, Mick, it is basically a ballpark as an island surrounded by water. And then the least of these things was a 4.3 decibel earthquake that shook us up in Lake County right outside of Cleveland before we took on the Lake County Captains in a game. That wasn't so bad. That shook us up, but 3 seconds, 4 seconds, none of the utter damage and the irreparable harm that it's caused to people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, I've been through a pretty bad tornado, 2011, April 27th in Tuscaloosa. It was part of a string of tornadoes that I think killed, I want to say, 140 people maybe. I mean, it was pretty devastating, and actually left the team and volunteered for a week in Tuscaloosa just to do what I could to help. I know how tough those are, and man, I hope that everyone's kind of getting back on their feet again and Dayton in those areas. But it's been a weird weather year for sure. You know, we spent it felt like 2 weeks at the beach. We played Biloxi on the Gulf of Mexico and then came back to Tennessee and then went back and played Pensacola, and I mean there was hardly any rain, and it's been like all the rain's been kind of in the middle of the country, you know, so we've gotten a lot of that too, just all the rain up north that's come down south.
Ooh. Your first half of the year, we are now halfway through the minor league baseball season, maybe a couple of days after that to boot. Was there anything that stood out to you from that first half that maybe you had not experienced before?
You know, it's been kind of a pedestrian first half for me. It's just been, you know, there's been some rain, a lot of rain at home, which we're not used to, and we're way over the normal rainfall level here in East Tennessee. But it's been a lot of fun. Our manager Jimmy Gonzalez has made the season one that is memorable in a good way. You know, he's just got the clubhouse really loose. He's fun to be around. It's a great interview. You know, I try to talk to him every series with our manager's report, and that's something that I, as a broadcaster, really enjoy doing. It's one of the fun parts outside of play-by-play with my job, you know, and not every manager is comfortable with an interview, you know, it's just not something that they're, you know, that they like to do. Like, take Montgomery, for example, their manager, Morgan Insberg, doesn't do interviews. You know, Mark Johnson was our manager the last few years, and, you know, he would do them, but it just wasn't something that was easy for him, you know, and not everyone can articulate exactly what it is that's going on with the team, and you know, that maybe it's just not in their, you know, in their personality, you know. But in the major leagues right now, if you're going to be a big league manager, being comfortable with the media is a really important part of the job. And you look at the Cubs and Joe Maddon, I've never seen anyone better at it than Joe, you know, where he can kind of tell you what he thinks. He can be honest, but at the same time, you know, be relaxed and make it an enjoyable, you know, part of the day for the guys that got to interview him. And, you know, listening to him and Ron Coomer do their daily interviews for the Cubs broadcast is one of the best parts of the whole show, you know. So, and it's an important thing that if you're going to be a big league manager that you need to learn. But when you're in the minor leagues, you know, you might not be a big league manager when you get to the major leagues. That may never even be the goal for you. You know, you may just be doing it, and then eventually you're going to get to the big leagues and be a base coach or a bench coach, you know, something that you really don't have to do the media part of it. But you get to a big market, particularly the Cubs, you're going to have to be able to talk about what's going on with the team, and you got to do it every day.
It's something that my manager with the Lansing Lugnuts, Dallas McPherson, has focused on. And he said to me right from the very start of the year, even though he played in the major leagues, he worked his way up, he played so many games in the minors, he understands that being interviewed, let's say being that interview subject, that's a skill. And that's not a skill that a lot of people have. It's a skill that needs to be worked on. Maybe you can be a good talker, but how do you find the right words? How do you give the right information? How do you know which information to give? How do you cultivate those relationships? So I've been working with him this year on what makes a good interviewee.
Yeah, I mean, like, and I was surprised, you know, when you hear that, you know, Ensberg doesn't do interviews and that he doesn't really understand how that helps the team. You know, I adamantly disagree with him. And I mean, like, look, I'm coming from the media aspect of the everyday broadcast and baseball crew, you know, and it's like that's how you get the message out to the fans of what's going on with your team, you know, and a lot of managers, I mean, look at, and I'm just going to switch to football for a second, but look at Nick Saban. He uses those opportunities to talk to the team sometimes. And I'm sure there's big league managers that do the same thing too, but you know, professional sports, you know, maybe in Tampa Bay, you know, you're not dealing with a big media market, but you go to New York or Chicago or LA, there's a lot of people that are interested in your team. And they want to know what's going on, and they want to know why you made a decision or why someone's not playing or why someone's doing well, you know, and that's your chance to get in front of the people and explain to them, hey, here's why we're having success, or here's why we're not having success right now, and here's what we're trying to do, and here's what we are doing.
I think this question was just raised especially because of the New York Mets with Mickey Callaway and with Jason Vargas. And I saw someone comment, why do they need to be interviewed? What is the point of this? And I think that you've answered it saliently in terms of it is part of the coverage. It is a partnership of the team. It's part of the contract. It's part of the responsibilities of the job. But if you want to, as a manager or as a ball player, if you want to do your job with none of that coverage, with nobody paying attention to you, it will not come with a salary. It comes with having attention upon you. It comes with, here's why you're being paid money for your job, is because people care, because there are those eyes on you, because there are those tickets being sold, the advertising revenue, the sponsorship, and everything like that. It is part of everything else that comes with it. It is not just writing out the lineup card or managing the team or swinging the bat, whatever else. It is the entire part of the whole.
Yeah, and I mean, what we have to remember, no matter what job we have in professional sports, is that the only reason that we get to live the lifestyle, that we get to watch the game every day, that these guys get to play the game every day, is that the people in the stands are paying money to watch the games and to be part of the game. And it's a game. You know, it's not politics. It's not running government. It's not a business as far as, you know, like Walmart or Apple. It's a game. And people want to get as much information as they can about the game, you know, and when I see players like Chris Bryant that go out of their way to sign an autograph or, you know, greet a fan, you know, it just makes the game more popular and it gives people the experience that they want to get from the game. And it's the same thing with doing the interviews. If you're a manager, you know, like you're giving back to the fans that make this thing go. And it's, you know, and at the big league level, more so than down here, you know, it's required.
It's It's a fascinating thing to think about in terms of what ingredients are necessary for success, especially because you and I, as we see it, we are very much involved in the baseball side. We understand the development part, but we also see the front office side. We see how much energy is poured into what can be done to bring more folks out to the ballpark. Well, is it the giveaways? Is it the fireworks? Is it a discount? What can you do in order to make sure that there are eyes upon the field and that there are folks in the stands, in those seats?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think about that all the time. You know, attendance in Major League Baseball has been trending down. And I think there's a lot of things that baseball could do, the players could do, the owners could do, the media could do, you know, all of us could do to make this game more popular. You know, when I was a kid, I mean, you know, football and basketball were second to baseball. You know, and when baseball season started, everything else just seemed to kind of stop, you know. And other sports have gotten more popular, even soccer now. And I feel like part of that is that, you know, we have, as a profession, as a sport, you know, have done less for the fans to make the game interesting. You know, we've kind of been stuck back in doing things, you know, the way that they were done a long time ago, and things have changed. The media's changed. You know, technology's changed. When I watch, you know, the home plate umpires miss strike calls and ball calls, and there's no, like, way of going back and correcting those when we have the technology, it bugs me, you know. And you look at the NFL, and, you know, they have the technology with the instant replay, and even on the bases now in baseball to get things right, you know. And I think fans want that. They want the game to be, you know, officiated well. I also think that the level of play is important, you know, and making it a fun game. You know, baseball wants to make it a faster game. You know, I'm not necessarily on that boat 100%, but there's things that we can do, you know, maybe playing more exhibition games in places that don't have Major League Baseball, which was something that in the past was done a lot, and it's not done hardly at all now. Although I thought it was a really great exhibition to see, you know, the game that was played right before the College World Series in Omaha, the first ever big league regular season game that was played there. You know, and to have Kansas City come back, where their AAA affiliate is, a team that plays there all the time, and bring the excitement of Major League Baseball to the heartland, I thought was great. You know, and I would love to see that happen in the South and, you know, states like Tennessee, which doesn't have Major League Baseball, and around the country. You know, I think that the more exposure that the players, the star players get on the national stage, even outside of the Chicagos and New Yorks and LAs and other markets that have big league baseball, is really going to be beneficial in the long haul.
That was something that they used to do, was the major league teams would go traveling around the country and say to every fan around the different states, around the different regions, here's what it's like to watch these great players in person. That's something that I remember going to RFK Stadium and seeing Mark McGwire and the St. Louis Cardinals take on Vladimir Guerrero, the first one, and the Montreal Expos. And I'm not going to forget that exhibition game before the season, and it was a blast.
Well, and the story that I use a lot is one that was told to me by Billy Williams, the Hall of Famer, the Cubs Hall of Famer, sweet swinging Billy Williams. And Billy and I have become friends over the years. And we talk a lot about, you know, his days growing up in Whistler, Alabama. And he said he got into baseball because the Brooklyn Dodgers used to play an exhibition game in Mobile every year. And he would go. And when he said when those guys would get off the bus, including Jackie Robinson, they were 10 foot tall, you know, and he was a kid and he would stand out there and watch, and he wanted to be a Jackie Robinson, you know, or whoever. I mean, he wanted to be a major leaguer, and that inspired him, you know, and not only did he achieve that, he's a Hall of Famer. He's one of the best that ever played the game. So, you know, would his life have been different, you know, had Jackie and the Dodgers not played the Indians back then, you know, and Bob Feller in the gang, you know, in an exhibition game. And I wonder that myself. You know, I love reading the stories about, you know, Babe Ruth hitting a home run here in Knoxville, you know, or Ted Williams playing somewhere, you know, when they used to stop and play on those train tours, you know, along the way to start the regular season. I think baseball is the best game that's ever been played and ever been invented, you know, and I think the more that people see it, you know, even down here in the South where it's college football country or you know, in the Midwest where you're at, the more exposure that, that people have to this game, I think the more they'd like it. And there's so much more to it than just, you know, kicking a ball through a goal. You know, there's a game, and then there's the game within the game, and then there's everything that's going on. It takes a long time to figure it out, but baseball's chess. It's the closest thing that we have to chess in a physical game. And I think that's one of the main reasons that I like it so much.
That, to my mind, too, is why baseball resists being a good TV sport, is because there's just too much to process that one camera can't do it. I was always bothered as a kid whenever a runner got on to first base and the camera now was split, and they're trying to show you the runner's lead, but they're also trying to show you the pitcher focusing on the batter, and I couldn't focus on that on the TV because the camera's jerking me back and forth. In person, you can look at whatever you need to look at in baseball. You can see exactly how the fielders are all positioned. You can see the transferring of signs. You don't have to worry about the director back saying, okay, get this camera shot, get that camera shot.
Yeah, well, it's funny you bring that up. You know, when I've gone to Wrigley Field at the end of the Smoky season, and sometimes during the season for a visit, John Walsh, Mark Brady, you know, Bob Verval, the guys that run the games every night, you know, they've allowed me to go into the truck and watch from behind the scenes exactly how they produce Cubs baseball. And it's just fascinating, you know, being in the truck and, you know, and hearing John or Mark like direct the cameras on, you know, where to go and what camera shot to use. It's crazy because you're in this truck, you know, like this tractor trailer with all these monitors. And then, you know, and how seamless they go from one shot to the next, you know, to bring baseball to television, you know. And when I was a kid, you know, I loved to watch it. I mean, you're talking about maybe four cameras, right? A center field camera, dugout cameras, and maybe a home plate camera. And now you have a lot more. And with HD, you know, you can really get, you know, a great picture of exactly what's going on. And, you know, and I mean, we can watch every single game right here on our iPads, you know, or our computer, you know, with the MLB package. And so I've seen a lot more television baseball now than I did as a kid. You know, I listened to so many games on the radio with, we've talked about this on our show before, you know, Chuck Thompson and John Miller. And we had a This Day in Baseball History this week, which was personally, selfishly, I put it on there. I mean, I picked them the days, but it was 1979 when Doug DeCinci hit a walk-off home run, which they didn't even call them walk-offs back then. And it led the Orioles to a dramatic win over the Tigers at Memorial Stadium, and it ignited what we know as Orioles Magic, right? And that's the song Orioles Magic, and they still call it Orioles Magic, although there's no magic in Baltimore anymore, at least not right now. But you know, back then in the you know, the 60s, the late 60s and the 70s, and then the early 80s up until 83, they were this, you know, juggernaut, and they were always known for being a team that in the late innings could, you know, would figure out a way to push and win games, you know. And
I can still sing that song too.
Oh yeah, well I sung a little bit of it for Spencer Siegel here, my partner, and right on the air. So I'm sure people were turning their radios off at that point. But you know, if we think about it, we grew up like every time you would jog out of a dugout and you run on the field, you know, you're like, let the magic happen. You know, like you got your glove tucked under your arm, you're heading out to your position, and
exactly.
I'm thinking of Bill O'Donnell, who was on the air back then, and Chuck Thompson and Charlie Ekman, you know, like those guys, those Baltimore broadcasters, and just how good they were, you know. And then John Miller after that, and Fred Manfra and Joe Angel, and you know, and now it's a different crew now. But and what it must have been like that day, you know, did anyone realize like this home run was going to be so epic in the history of this franchise, you know, and to be able to broadcast that on the air, which is what we all dream of doing, you know, as radio guys. And I think now, you know, here in 2019, it would be, you know, I saw it on television, you know, and so it'd be less words and more picture. But you just want to capture that moment, you know. And live that magic that happened on that particular night, you know. But being able to kind of go back and think about those guys that inspired us to do this job was really what my whole point was of having that as our baseball history.
Let me tell you a tale of a walk-off electrifying home run that just happened recently. The Midwest League All-Star Game ended in a tie, and the MWL All-Star Game has had recent history of having close games late. Last year was hosted by Lansing, and it was tied at the end of 9 innings, so they played an extra inning, and they said, if neither team scores in the 10th, it's just going to be a tie. That's the way it's going to be. And then with 2 strikes, 2 outs, bottom half of the 10th inning, 1 pitch away from a tie, the Dayton Dragons player Montrell Marshall wins it with a walk-off single. All right, so here we are this year. It ends 9 innings. They're all tied up. It's 3-3. They don't go to extras. They go to home run derby off. Each team's manager chooses a home run hitter. Western Division chooses Blaze Alexander out of the Arizona Diamondbacks system. The Eastern Division chooses Chris Betts out of the Tampa Bay Rays system, who had just been the home run derby champion the day before. Alexander hits one homer. I believe they gave him 60 seconds. I forget what they gave him as an increment. And so Chris Betts only has to hit 2 home runs to win it. And he steps up there, and all the players crowded around. And the Western Division is trash-talking him like Dennis Eckersley would not have liked now as a broadcaster, getting in his face, letting him have it. And he hits one, and he hits another, and he whips the bat into right center field, and they went nuts.
Really? That was like the Midwest League. What? Say that again. That's amazing. Like, so they had a home run derby to figure out who won an All-Star game because it was tied.
They had a home run derby to figure out who won the All-Star game because it was tied.
That is absolutely brilliant. I love it. After we played 3 extra inning games in a row to end the first half. 2 of those games. The second baseman, Christian Donahue, who throws like 60, came in to pitch because the Smokies ran out of pitching, and it was just the worst. I mean, it was, you know, it's just bad for the game, you know. I mean, and this kid's out there doing the best he can do, but he's not a pitcher. He's pitched 4 times in his life. That's 2 in that series, once last year and once in high school. I mean, how much fun would that be? I mean, compared to like having, you know, someone that's a professional infielder pitching, I would much rather get to a point where you're like, you know what? You give me your best home run guy. You take your best home run guy, and let's figure this out. That's awesome.
I'm fully on board. And especially because you and I hear so much, minor leagues is about development. The major leagues, you want to win or lose. Minor leagues, there's a bigger picture than just trying to win and lose that night. So in that case, do it for the fans.
Yeah, that's crazy. And it's a great idea. I mean, it's like penalty kicks in soccer. Now, I'm not saying I would want that to decide postseason games, right?
No, because then you actually do care about wins and losses.
Right, but you know what though? In the minor leagues, I'd say if you played like, say you play like 11 innings and no one is still tied, if they did that in the 12th inning, I'd be so for it. I think that would be really fun.
I was talking to a scout once because the game had gone into extra innings and was getting later and later. And the scout said, you just have to know as a manager, which pitcher do I have who can lose me this game so I don't have to burn anybody else? Because sometimes you just need to end the game, find a game ender.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's the situation that we were in. You know, the Cubs are, they have player plans for all the guys on their team. You know, back in, I don't know, when I first got into this, like, you may bring a starter in and, you know, he's going to throw his bullpen in the game, you know, so he was going to throw maybe, you know, that day or the next day anyway, and then you get an inning out of him, and then you try to figure out who can go an extra inning. You know, they don't do that, the Cubs, at least not at this level. They're not going to stretch a guy out. And while he's only going to throw 2, we're going to throw him 3. Or he threw yesterday, he's going to throw today. You know, they don't value winning these games over the development of their players where someone could get hurt. And, you know, that's their philosophy. You know, teams are trying to figure out how to protect arms. That's the way that the Cubs do it. It's tough when you're a fan of these minor league teams because you want to win. And I don't always feel like winning's the priority with the Cubs, but I'm not knocking that. I mean, I just, you know, when you see a guy throwing 60 out there, you know, in the 12th or 11th inning of the game, you know, like, hey, just like you just said, you know, how can I lose this game and get out of here, you know? And a home run derby to me would be a 60 seconds. How many balls can you hit out? That would probably suffice. I think that would be exciting, and you save your pitching, you know. Or maybe you do it where you say, hey, look, you've talked to both managers and it's like, look, we got enough pitching for 11. If it goes past that, we'll do it in the 12th, or maybe we only have enough pitching for 10 and we'll do it in the 11th, you know, or something like that. But I think that would be really fun.
Well, especially because you think about the players that you've seen in the past who are just 5 o'clock hitters. And you understand, once the game begins and they start seeing breaking stuff, they're not actually going to put on any show in the real game. Their best shots always come when the game doesn't count. So those are the types of guys that you actually get to say to the crowd, look, I know that you've been frustrated. I know he struck out a lot, but watch what kind of strength he has.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about it, right. But, I mean, it's also, I mean, look, it would be a really fun way to get everyone involved and kind of have like a dramatic finish to a minor league game. Now, I wouldn't advocate that for the big leagues, but for here, you know, where like you're really kind of strapped on how many pitchers you have for a particular game, what a way to give the fans something to leave and be excited about.
Let me offer this too. This might not always have been your experience with a position player pitching, but as it so happens, we were taking on the Cubs affiliate in South Bend, Indiana, and they had to go to a position player pitching. I have never seen a faster pitcher on the mound because the pitcher has so many different things that are going through his head. He's looking in for the signs. He's thinking about his mechanics, what he's been working on in the side sessions. It was Rafael Maria, an infielder, and all he was thinking about was playing catch with the catcher. It was the quickest inning I have ever seen. And batters were fouling off pitches and taking pitches. But he literally would get the ball back from the catcher and chuck in another pitch. It was glorious.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons why the game takes so long is, you know, how long it takes the pitchers to throw the pitch home, you know. And that's why us in the minor leagues here, you know, and you know this, we have the pitch clock and they're trying to speed that up, you know, because in the major leagues, you know, guys will take some of them, you know, a long time between pitches and, you know, and that certainly makes the game longer. But I'm not a fan of the position players pitching minor leagues or in the major leagues. And when that happens, it's not as good of a game unless it's, you know, someone that is, you know, a player that's has the ability to do both, you know, and do both at an elite level, you know. So to me, it's never fun when you see, you know, Victor Caratini, who pitched for the Cubs like a couple days ago against the Mets, you know, even though he might have made the defensive play of the season, you know, in a 10-1 loss, I just prefer to have the guys that pitch that are getting paid for it and that are pros do it. And, you know, like coming up with ideas like that, I'm also, I mean, this is kind of digressing a little bit, but in Japan, you get to a certain point and it's a tie game. You know, I'm fine with that too, although I feel like that having the quick home run derby at the end of everything leaves people with that excitement of, you know, hey man, that was a crazy finish. You know, you're talking about this guy hit two and then this guy hit three and the last one was the winner. Yeah, that's fun to me.
This might sound as an unusual comparison for you. When I think about pitchers and batters with their in-between pitches routine, it makes me think about a basketball player stepping up to the free throw line to shoot a free throw. That you might have a player, let's say, I'm going to go back a little bit. Kobe Bryant, the referee would toss him the ball. There'd be no dribbles usually. He would just put it up with his form. And then I remember Karl Malone back in the 1990s who would take so long that the fans would count to 10 because you had a maximum of 10 seconds allowed on the free throw, and he would take every bit of that. Watching players now, it's the same thing as that free throw routine, as it's all the different practice things that certain players have. We have a slugger on our squad who steps outside the box, practice cut, half practice cut, adjust this, adjust that, because it's all about that mental focus, mentally getting it right. And so there's something to that, clearing the mechanism. But at the same time, I am pro pitch clock or pro some way, just making sure that the routine speeds up. If the batter is doing his job, he's going to work a deep count. And if he's doing his job and working a deep count, and he's taking his time with all of his different routines between everything, you can get five pitches into an at-bat before anything has occurred in terms of a ball getting put into play. And by that point, now you're minutes into the at-bat. And I don't know how you feel. I go into a half inning maybe not thinking, all right, I'm going to tell this story in this half inning. But I can tell innately I'm going to need to tell a story right now because there is nothing going on in this at-bat.
Yeah, I prepare a certain number of stories, you know, and content. You know, I try to have some player information to dip into. But when the game's played well, you know, you don't have as much time for all of that stuff. Although I'm trying to prepare every day for 4 hours. You know, I figure like 4 hours is about as long of a game as I can think of on just a night where the game's not ending. You know, it's just a slow, methodical type of night, you know. So I try to prepare for four and then, you know, and hopefully I don't use everything, you know. And when the game, like to me, and Spence and I, you know, in the Smokies booth, we were debating this. We had a game yesterday that was, I think it was like a 9-7 final, and he loved it. You know, he said 9-7. You know, that's the kind of game I like. You know, but for me, a 2-1 game, a 1-0 game. I like pitching and defense, and so you know that's all I need for a good time at the ballpark.
I relate it to movies. There are certain movies that they don't feel to me like they're 2 hours long or 3 hours long, however long it might be, because the movie is so well made, I am in. And there are other movies that I can tell when scenes drag, or I can tell when we've hit the lull. Baseball games are the same way. If a baseball game is played in rhythm, I'll look at the box score at the end of the game and go, 3 hours, 22 minutes, didn't feel like that. And other games, 2 hours, 20, 2 hours, 30 minutes, and I'm going, yeah, but it was a real rough 2 hours, 30 minutes to get through.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that, too. I mean, a good game's a good game, and a bad game's a bad game. And, I mean, I guess there's really no time you can put on there. You know, to kind of quantitate it. But you know what? A 4 hour game with a lot of excitement and great plays and, you know, and good at bats, it doesn't feel like 4 hours. And honestly, I mean, there's only a few games a year that I look back on and go, you know, that I couldn't wait to get out of the ballpark. You know, to me, I really enjoy the 3 hours about that we spend watching the games. At this level, and I mean, even at the big league level, there was a spring training game that I worked this year with Zach Zabin of the Score. That was awful. I mean, it was fun, but it was awful. I mean, like it was just, you know, three different changes of players and like a lot of runs, and it was like, you know, I think the Cubs scored 20 or something, and they hit one home run. So you can imagine it was a lot of really long innings. And there weren't many three up, three downs, you know. But those games are tough, but at the same time, you know, you're still enjoying the fact that it's a game and you watch it and you know, try to figure out, during spring training anyway, like, you know, what someone brings to the table, you know. And some of those games gives you an opportunity to see, like, a prospect that you might not have been able to watch yet. Maybe they're going to get extended innings. And you know what, I mean, it's baseball, you know, so at the end of the day, that's why we're doing this, because we love the game.
Let me add this though. You know who else is suffering through that long game? It's the players. It's the manager. It's the coaches. They are having as big of a difficulty as we are. I don't know if you've had this happen. I've had manager, a coach, a player come after me after talk to me at the end of a long game and just say, "Well, I don't know how you made it. I was having troubles down in the bullpen or down on the bench or down at shortstop. That was a rough one."
Yeah, and they've got to go through those too, you know. Except in spring training, you know, when you're the star player, you just, you know, you play your three innings and then you get your bats and your bat bag and you walk right down the side and get out of there. You know, like the minor leaguers got to stick it out, you know. But if you're a minor leaguer and you're in one of those spring training games, you know, you're thinking like, hey, this is what I'm doing this for, you know. It might be your first taste of Major League Baseball, even though it's in a spring game in Arizona or Florida. For these minor league games that last forever, you know, you've got to learn how to win those games. Philip Wellman I saw today that I think this was the anniversary of Phil Wellman's, you know, epic ejection when he was with Mississippi playing in Chattanooga. And I'm kind of glad that we're doing the show because I want to talk about Philip Wellman and that ejection if we do have time. And I mean, we've all seen the video, you know, where he throws the grenade and he walks off at the bases and everything. But he told me one time in an interview, he said, you know, he had a good team in Mississippi, and I think they ended up, if I'm not wrong, winning the Southern League. But he said, you know, we got to win. You know, we want to win the quick games. We want to win the ugly games. We want to win the pretty games. You know, we want to win the sloppy games, whatever. You know, like, you got to figure out a way to win all of those games. Because over the course of 140 in the minor leagues or 162 in the big leagues, you're going to have those games. And every single one of them counts the same. And so you got to figure out a way to get those, you know, in the W column. And the way to do it is, you know, in the minor leagues, develop players who know how to win.
It's amazing to me that people remember that one, and perhaps it's because of the video. I'm certain he must have had 5 or 10 others that were tremendous, because I saw one Wellman ejection one day where it was all about he didn't like that the home plate umpire wasn't appealing down to the first base umpire. And so he went out there, gave the umpire a piece of his mind, umpire gave him the heave-ho, and so he somehow steered the umpire aside without touching it. He got in behind the catcher. You can already picture this. He pretended to be the umpire. Then there was a pretend check swing. He made sure the umpire showed, this is how you appeal. He raced down to first base, and he showed, no swing. It was amazing. And what I remember was that he would always get ejected right in the teeth of either a losing streak or if it was just a terribly humid week, and he could tell that his team needed a pick-me-up. His ejections got his teams going. I loved Wellman as a manager.
Yeah, and I do too. And I'm going to tell you a few things too. And I agree with you, what you're saying. First off, that particular video that we saw, that was kind of the beginning of where people could just videotape things with, you know, like cell phones and stuff like that and get it out there. The social media age kind of started right there with that ejection video, because he'd been getting ejected and playing it up for years. Philip Wellman's one of my favorite managers. I never had him on my team, but when I worked for Chattanooga, he had managed there and they absolutely loved him. And I heard all of the stories about the Wellman ejections and how much the fans liked it. And he was a showman, you know, and baseball has had manager ejections as far as the game's been played, right? And I mean, you go back and you look at some of the greatest managers of all time, and they got thrown out a lot. And Earl Weaver, Baltimore manager, you know, known for his ejections. Billy Martin animated with his. Bobby Cox got thrown out a lot, maybe not as animated, but still thrown out of games a lot. It's a way to motivate your team. It's a way to get the guys loose. It tells them that you care. Sometimes you get thrown out because you're protecting a player. Sometimes you're getting thrown out because you're protesting a bad call. And maybe there's other reasons too, but Philip Wellman was with the Braves. He was back in Chattanooga, beloved manager. And in the minor leagues, your managers sometimes are more the face of the team than the players, you know, because they're the ones that actually stick around for a long time and are – you know, are the face that you know you're going to have from day one until, you know, day 40, you know, and day 140, you know, like throughout the season. So Wellman was a very popular manager in Chattanooga, and then he was with the Braves, and obviously they're in town. I remember Frank Burke owned the team at the time, and he loved Philip Wellman. And we knew, like, hey, there could come a point, you know, where Philip Wellman gets thrown out of a game and kind of does those things. He was never doing it to show up the umpires. It was just part of the entertainment and the showmanship of that job, the way that it had been done really before the internet age, you know, and then it happened. And all of a sudden something that had been going on, not just with Wellman, but other managers for years, became this national story, you know, and he got suspended and the Braves weren't happy about it. But I'd say who cares? You know, I loved every minute of it, and I wish that managers would still do that, and I wish that the umpires, you know, could could look at that and kind of get that it's, you know, as it's not showing you up. It's just fun. You know, he's just being funny. I mean, you see him, he goes back into the dugout and he holds his hands up to the crowd. He's in Chattanooga with the Braves and he's getting a standing ovation from the Lookouts fans, you know, because they love him. And I'm just telling you, like, there's a lot more to it than just, you know, the video and this guy's crazy. He's not crazy. He's motivating his team. He's having a good time. And there was nothing personal to the umpires. I wish it had happened more. I haven't seen a good manager ejection like that in a long time. You know, you see him get ejected, but you don't see him throwing the umpires out of the game anymore as much, you know, and stuff like that. But they used to, you know, and growing up in Baltimore, you remember Earl Weaver was famous for those lines. I mean, Earl got thrown out both ends of a doubleheader. But it was a pleasure watching Philip Wellman manage. And I'm telling you, if I had a top five, you know, managers list from the Southern League, he'd be right at the top.
The Earl Weaver, that generation of managers that knew to turn their baseball caps around, and that way they could really go nose to nose with the umpire, or the kicking dirt on the umpire's feet. I don't know if you saw the Gabe Kapler ejection where he made sure to kick a little bit of dirt on the umpires before he was gone. There was an Earl Weaver story. It was told about how his pitcher, might have been Jim Palmer, was called for a balk. And Earl stormed out there, first brief word with Jim Palmer. Did you balk? And Jim goes, oh, yeah, I balked. And Earl goes, okay, just wondering. And then gave the umpire hell for the next 10 minutes. Great stuff. About Phil Wellman, with a personal story. I go down there. I'm the assistant for Jim Tocco with Montgomery, so I'm bringing in the starting lineup, so the box scores. I'm perpetually going downstairs into the visiting manager's room in Montgomery, Alabama, and I knocked on the door, and I hear a gruff shout, come in! And I opened up the door very cautiously, and there Phil Wellman is, laying into one of his guys on the couch. Players on the couch in the visiting manager's office. He's at his desk, just screaming at the guy. And he points at me, he goes, you see what he did? He knocked. You, next time you want to talk with me, you knock too. And he sent the player on his way. The player left, head down, and he looks at me. He accepts the lineup, and he goes, some guys just don't know to knock. Thank you for illustrating it. And then I was gone. That was the whole lesson, and I had illustrated it without even thinking.
Yeah, that's just funny. I interviewed him a few times when he was in the league, and one in particular I remember, the one that I was telling you about where he was explaining to me, like, trying to win games and lose games. I had a job one year where the president of the Smokies wanted me to get newspapers from every city that we played in. And he was basically trying to figure out how much money the other teams were spending on newspaper ads. So the best way he thought to do it was to see how much newspaper coverage that the team was getting, you know. So I would pick up newspapers from every city and bring them back, and then he'd look through them. Well, one of them, we were playing none other than Montgomery, and I'm not sure if you were there or not. You might have been. And Philip Wellman had an ejection there, and he built like a sandcastle on top of home plate. So it was a picture. the cover of the Montgomery paper was the sandcastle that Philip Wellman had built, and this was before the epic ejection that happened today. So it was that same season. And there was this sandcastle, you know, that he had built with the dirt right around home plate. So funny. And there was a picture on there. And so I asked Philip Wellman about that. I should have got him to sign that.
Yeah, absolutely. What a legend. What an absolute legend of a minor league manager.
Yeah, no doubt, man. And that's what people, they just want to come out here and be entertained, you know. And I don't think that kind of stuff hurts development or anything like that. I think it's great.
Well, I think let's go right back to the original point, right? The whole idea of the media, doing those interviews, everything like that. It's understanding what is the bigger picture of your job. Your job as a manager, your job as a player. What are all the different things that go in? And this does not interfere with that development. It does not interfere with whether it's winning games or giving your best effort or anything like that. It is something, as a matter of fact, that can enhance it all.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, like, it's a game. You know, and at the end of the day, that's what we have to remember. I mean, it's an entertainment sport. You know, people are out here to be entertained, you know, and when you take the fun out of the game, then, you know, less people are going to like to watch it. When I hear players get angry that someone watched a home run too long or flipped a bat and all that stuff, I just think that times are different now, you know. Get over it. If the guy hits a home run, let him flip the bat. And if you strike him out, you know, pump your fist. Spike the baseball. Who cares? Have fun. Get into this game. Enjoy it. Go out there and play it with everything you got. And don't be offended when someone else gets joy out of it. You know, it's not everything that happens is showing someone else up. You know, it's 2019 is not, you know, 1919. And it's not 1979. You know, it's where we are right now. And there's a lot more coverage, and you know, you watch the NFL, you watch the NBA, you know, the players are more flamboyant. They have celebrations, and I really don't think there's a problem with the players of our time entertaining the crowd and enjoying the sport while they're playing it.
This especially was brought back to the forefront with Marcus Stroman's shutout innings in Boston and Dennis Eckersley on the Red Sox TV airwaves not being too happy with that, which led folks to go back in time and say, hey, Eck, you remember what you were like as a pitcher?
Yeah, well, I got a story. You know, Greg Maddux told me this. Braves are playing the Cardinals. And I said, did anyone ever show you guys up? You know, was there ever a moment where someone did something and it motivated you guys? And he says, yeah, there just happened to be one. He said, we're playing the Cardinals. Eckersley's the closer. It's a playoff game. He said that, you know, he got us out. They won. And then he pointed in our dugout. And I'm doing the motion right now, but it's like one, fingers out, 1-1-1-1. Like he's pointing. He's like, you know, up and down, pointing in the dugout. So they're walking back to the tunnel. And I think Mad Dog said it was David Justice, who was like, you know, hell no. You know, we're not letting these guys beat us. And if you remember, the Braves came back and whooped the Cardinals and won that series. And that was why. So, you know what? That's the game, you know? I mean, and I don't have a problem with what Eckersley did, but it motivated the Braves, you know? So I just think that we just need to keep in perspective exactly what is going on here, and that's that it's a sport. It's a game, man. And it's like these guys want to have fun and enjoy their moments, then they should be able to do that. And I don't have a problem with what Eckersley did, and I don't have a problem with what Stroman did, and I don't have a problem with Javi Baez watching his eventual game-winning home run yesterday. That's why you play the game, to enjoy it and have fun.
Do you remember Derek Lowe eliminating the A's, pitching for the Red Sox in the postseason, and then giving a crotch chop to the Oakland A's dugout afterward?
Well, you know, like you do stuff like that, and it might come back to haunt you a little bit if you ever get back and have to hit. You know, but at the same time, you know, I mean, you don't want to be obscene with your gestures.
No. But I encourage you, look up Chris Betts winning the Home Run Derby and winning the Midwest League All-Star Game with a home run swing off, and watch to see where he throws his bat into the outfield, and it's awesome. Mick, thank you for getting back together and chatting once more.
Yeah, we needed to do this. You know, it's good to be back on track again, and I say we try to make it a little bit shorter between our next get-together.
I'm on it. He's Mick Gillespie, the voice of the Tennessee Smokies. I'm Jesse Goldberg-Strasser with the Lansing Lugnuts, and this is the Ballpark Digest Broadcaster Chat. Thank you for listening.